We have coming up an outstanding guest.
Outstanding?
Yeah.
They're always outstanding.
Yeah, but this one's intriguing. How about that one? Intriguing? Controversial?
Is it controversial?
I believe that he's raised the hair on people's back with an article in the online magazine From the Wilderness,
mm-hmm.
where he's the science editor.
We're speaking about Dave Allen Pfeiffer, who's the science editor at FromTheWilderness.com.
Uh-huh.
And if you're not familiar with this website, it has a lot to do with international politics, conspiracies, peak oil, global food supply, that sort of thing. It's and the piece that Dale wrote, he originally wrote it in 2003, and it's had a couple of different waves of readings on the net, and it was republished on FromTheWilderness.com, and it basically talks about, it's called Eating Fossil Fuels, and it describes in great detail the extent of fossil fuel inputs in the food that we eat. And I'm running out of things to say.
No, what's fascinating about it right now is the gas prices keep going up. And what
yes,
you
today what, today in Irvine, it's something like, you know, it's $3.35 now, which people's I'm kind of excited by that personally, because
yeah,
it's finally
that's what it should be
entering the American consciousness that, ooh, this is actually expensive.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I think it's going to take a little while longer for it to reach the American consciousness, to the extent to which that gas price is going to show up in their Twinkies.
Yeah. It's not just about filling up your SUV.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the suppliers trying to get food to this neck of the woods. If you've noticed, we've wiped out all the the dairies and the croplands, mm-hmm. and anything that,
and we're going to kill all of the chickens.
Yeah.
All the chickens left that we can't keep track of. We're back on the politics of food. We're joined by Dale Allen Pfeiffer. He's the he's the science editor for FromTheWilderness.com. Dale, are you with us?
Yes, I'm afraid that I have to correct that. I haven't been with FromTheWilderness.com for about a year.
Okay, thank you.
So how should we introduce you then?
Let's see. Well, I am the publisher and editor of the Mountain Sentinel, which you can find at www.mountainsentinel.com.
Okay.
And Dale, your piece I was introducing earlier is Eating Fossil Fuels, and you wrote this originally in 2003, and it's 3 years on now. What's your outlook at this point? You know, I was talking with Nathan earlier about the initial exposure to the public of the extent of fossil fuels in our daily lives is going to be the jump in gas prices right now. Can you start by talking about what this means for food, just in very simple terms?
Okay. Well, probably the most concise way to put it is that for each calorie of food that we consume in this country, we require 10 calories of fossil fuels to grow, process, and transport that food.
That doesn't sound very efficient.
No, it isn't. It is terribly inefficient. And that figure may actually be low, because that figure was arrived at before we began the process of globalization and the shipment across continents and around the globe of food supplies. The picture is very complicated, and now things are actually so bad that Iowa, which is, you know, considered to be the breadbasket of the United States and once produced a great diversity of food, Iowa right now cannot even feed itself.
Why is that so?
That is because they have gotten rid of the diversity of crops that they had there and instead concentrated on one or two key crops, that they can sell in the global market.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the distribution of their produce has evolved into a global market distribution. So they don't have the distribution infrastructure to distribute it to their own local population anymore.
Talk a little bit more about specifically about the inputs that go into this mechanism, this huge industrial agriculture that we live with today.
Okay, well, perhaps we should go back before the Green Revolution and talk for a moment about the evolution of agriculture. Up until the 1950s, pretty much all agricultural production throughout the world was based on the nutrients in the soil and sunlight. And you really couldn't produce more food than the incoming amount of sunlight allowed in combination with the amount of nutrients in your soil. In the 1950s and 1960s, we began developing what is called the Green Revolution. It involved some special varieties of plant types, but excuse me, for the most part, it was made possible through the use of oil and natural gas, fossil fuels. And natural gas was mainly used as the feedstock for nitrogen-based fertilizers. It's also used in phosphorus and potassium fertilizers, but mainly in nitrogen-based fertilizers. And oil, on the other hand, was used as the feedstock for pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also used in transport and, excuse me, oil-based energy was used to plant crops, to tend those crops, to harvest them, and to process them into packaged foods.
And has that increased to this day?
Yes, that has increased a great deal. I don't know how old either of you are, but I can remember back in the 1970s, we had processed food, and we had fast food, mm-hmm. but we didn't have the amount of it that we do now. Now, I've heard figures that people in grocery stores nowadays buy up to 75% processed foods as opposed to unprocessed foods, you know, raw beans or vegetables or meats or whatever.
It's getting harder and harder to walk into a grocery store and find a raw product of any kind.
Yes.
A raw ingredient to make food from. So, I mean, aside from that as just a common complaint that someone might have, how does that affect someone's well-being or their ability to support themselves as fuel shortages start to show up?
Okay, well, as fuel prices go higher, the prices of fertilizer, pesticides, and all the mechanically related prices, you know, planting, sowing, reaping, transport of produce, all of those costs rise as a function of oil and natural gas prices. So, as the price of oil and natural gas increase, that cost increase eventually makes its way into our supermarkets.
Can we anticipate what that cost is going to look like? I mean, do we have any idea?
No, we don't. However, back in the 70s, we experienced a somewhat similar situation. Back then, the fuel crisis that we had in the 70s was caused because in 1970, the United States peaked in oil production. So after that, our oil production started to decline. That made it possible for OPEC to wield the power it did during the 1970s and enforce embargoes and all that sort of thing. Eventually, we were able to break the power of OPEC and changed things back to, or moved back to the days of cheap oil, because it was just the U.S. that peaked at that time, and there was still plenty of cheap oil in the world. But what we're facing now is the same sort of thing, only on a worldwide scale. The whole world is peaking. There's no place to turn after this. Back then, food prices increased, and there were a number of problems that nobody could have foreseen. I remember there was a large trucker strike, mm-hmm. because the truckers were upset about the price of diesel.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that trucker strike, a lot of commodities suddenly were no longer available or were extremely expensive. I can remember I was in public school at the time, and our cafeteria staff experimented with making their own ketchup. And the experiment was a disaster.
Well, I have a recipe for that if you'd like it.
But in your article, Eating Fossil Fuels, you're talking about much more dire consequences than mm-hmm. just experimental ketchup. We're talking about a starvation on a grand scale here if we don't have a solution to the peak oil problem.
Because literally you're removing fossil fuels from an equation that requires fossil fuels.
Yes. The picture is different now because, you know, we don't have a place to turn for a new outlet of cheap fossil fuels. You know? So as our fossil fuel production declines, we are going to find ourselves in a tighter and tighter squeeze. And it's not something that will happen overnight. It's going to take time. For example, if we have a 2 to 3% decline in the production of fossil fuels, then by the year 2020, we'll be producing as much oil as we did in 1990. That doesn't sound bad, but then when you lay on top of that our increased consumption of oil and the population increase between 1990 and now, you see that there is a problem.
And it's not just American consumption. Now we have other competitors on the planet.
Yes.
To more of an extent.
Well, yeah. It's in your article you wrote that the Green Revolution resulted in a world grain production increase of 250%. And that was dependent on the oil. So, but it also gave a rise in the population because...
It made a huge population explosion possible.
Yeah,
and we have all this dependence now on. We have many more people dependent on oil, and we're taking away the main ingredient here of the equation. It seems like there's no other way to keep food production at the level it is right now except to have oil.
Yes, mm-hmm. And the picture is even further complicated because while we have had this industrialized agriculture, it has been extremely hard on the soil and the water supplies, the groundwater especially. And so now in many areas we're at the point where the soils on their own cannot support food crops. They have to have a fertilizer input.
So we don't have the same raw materials available that we did 30 years ago, even though we can conceive of these as renewable materials. They're not necessarily.
Yeah. Yes.
Have you, over the last, since you've written the article, do you feel, you've had a lot of fear when you wrote the first article. I could tell that you didn't like what it was that you were even writing. The conclusion you came to was frightening to you. And I guess the question is that even more so today, or do you feel that we have some solutions at hand?
Well, when I wrote that article, nobody else had pulled together all of this information in a non-scientific way. And so it was quite a blow to learn all of this, to see it all. When I wrote that, I was working for From the Wilderness, and both Mike Rupert, the publisher of From the Wilderness, and myself were extremely shocked by what I found. And we knew that there was going to be a large outcry because of it, and there really hasn't been, but that's simply because so many people haven't heard of it.
Haven't heard of it, or it's easier to ignore the painful conclusions that you come to, and it almost seems so fantastical that it can't possibly be true. And the conclusions that I'm talking about are what we talked about earlier, that this enormous increase in food production made possible a huge population explosion. And when you take away all that food, the logical conclusion would be an enormous decrease in population. And that's, I think, what frightens a lot of people. It is frightening.
Yes, yes. And the population will have to decrease. The question now is, can we make it an easy decrease? Can we make it possible for the population to decrease slowly, gradually, or is it something where you know, we're not going to make any changes and there's going to be a massive amount of suffering? That's the point we're at now.
And do you have any thoughts about that? I understand you have you're solidifying some of these thoughts in a book that's due out in about 6 months.
Yes, October of this year, I'll have a book out from New Society Publishers titled Eating Fossil Fuels. It's based upon the article. I add a lot of new information to it, and there's a large section in it about what people can do, about evolving a sustainable agriculture, about relocalization. There's a large section of contacts based on area, farmers markets, CSAs, that is community-supported agriculture, farms where people in the surrounding community subscribe to the farm on a yearly basis, and in return they receive a portion of the produce from the farm, plus help from the farmer's family on how to store the food. And in some cases, the subscribers even help with the harvest and the farm work. And a lot of other sources for trying to cope with this. We need a lot more community gardens, a lot more urban agriculture. 30% of our city surface is plantable in the way of rooftops. It's estimated that per city block, about 30% of the surface area is plantable. And we need to start looking at doing that.
I don't know. I've seen some real estate development around Southern California, and I'm not optimistic about the transition from normal urban industry to a more agriculture-friendly urban environment.
Yeah, right now, as far as most of the developers and planners and whatnot are concerned, they aren't even thinking about this. They're just putting in the tract mansions and trying to sell them off as quickly as possible. And, of course, the people that move into them, if they can even keep them once things get bad, which that's a big question in itself, if they can even keep them, they're not going to be able to go to the market. The market's too far away to walk to.
Or what would have been a market is now under their feet, under concrete.
Yeah.
Well, we live in, we're broadcasting from Irvine, California, one of the nation's flagship planned communities, where everything is hygienic and all the blast grades are the same, blades of grass are the same height. And Nathan, you've been a longtime resident of Irvine.
Yes. Well, I was here pretty much at the beginning, and this is, it's funny, I was just thinking, it started up a little bit after the Green Revolution. It was a planned community. It was even in, I want to say, Life magazine as the premier master plan community. Mm-hmm. Leviton, they just put the houses down, and they had tract homes. Lakewood, the same thing. But here, they wanted everything planned out so that you had your industrial over here and your housing over here and then your commercial in another place.
And somewhere about 300 miles away, you've got the wheat.
Yeah, and what's sad about that is with all the planning, they've restricted use so much here that people can't even pretty much grow their own vegetables in their front yard without violating CCR.
Yeah.
which is a shame. I think that's the type of stuff you're talking about, too, not just commercial areas with we have plenty of commercial areas with big flat rooftops that if they were reinforced, I know that they could we could use that to grow crops, but also just people on their own in their own yards pretty much are prevented from doing that. And what you're talking about is a major lifestyle change for nearly all Americans. Do you think that's possible?
Well, whether or not it's possible, it's something that we're going to have to do. Right now, I don't see a lot of people doing that. I happen to live in Irvine as well, actually, Irvine, Kentucky.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. So what... tell us about your community and the shape of it and what you've been able to do.
Well, we've only been living here for less than a year. So, you know, we're still in the process of moving in, but it's probably entirely the opposite of Irvine, California. In fact, they don't even pronounce it Irvine. They pronounce it Irvin.
Huh.
And
I'm going to start calling this place Irvin.
Yeah.
This is, in some ways, Irvin, Kentucky is somewhat of a ghost town. It used to be I won't say a big city, but it used to be a lively little town back when there was more coal production in this area. We live in the western end of Appalachia. And when the coal production in this region fell off, the center of town pretty much died. There's buildings there, but there isn't a whole lot in them. And we're actually not planning to stay here too awful long. We're planning on fixing up the house where we live right now and then selling it and moving elsewhere, because I don't see this area as being very viable once things go bad.
What do you mean by viable? What sorts of things enter into that definition of viable?
Well, most of the people who live here travel 20 miles to buy their groceries.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no place here to buy clothing or anything like that. There's one little furniture store, and there are a number of flea markets that are kind of like garage sales.
I think that describes a lot of American cities.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So if you're listening and you want to sort of look around your life and see, okay, you sort of see this coming down the pike, the first thing you want to do, you think, is look around you and determine if where you live is viable. Does that seem like an intelligent first step?
Yes, and when you're doing this, when you're thinking about where do I want to be, you know, you need to look at the area where you're at and think, is it viable? Can I grow enough food here for myself? Is my yard big enough? Is my yard oriented right? Do I have, you know, is my yard shaded by this big, large house to the south of me so that, you know, even though I have a fairly nice yard, it has too much shade for me to grow anything? Mm-hmm. You need to look at that sort of thing. You need to look at, you know, what can my community provide? You know, do we have the possibility or, you know, the possibility of, say, a clothing store or do we have one, you know, in existence even? All those sort of things. You know, what do we have, and what do we have especially within walking distance or within a short bicycle ride? And if you cannot answer yes to most of those sort of questions, then you should think seriously about moving. Now, when you think about moving, when you think that, I need to relocate, there are three areas where you could relocate to. There are rural areas, wilderness or semi-wilderness areas, and urban areas. Each one of those has their own problems and their own benefits. If you're going to move to a rural area, then you should plan on being an independent or semi-independent farmer.
Why is that?
Because you're going to be too far away to make weekly purchases of food or that sort of thing.
So you sort of have the opposite problem of living in a city.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, you're going to have to be able to grow most of what you need and work with your neighbors who may live, you know, up to a mile away from you. If you're going to move to a wilderness or semi-wilderness area, then you are going to want to be totally independent and self-sufficient in every way. And if you're really going to move to that sort of area, then you're probably thinking about hiding your location from outsiders. If you want to move to an urban area, then you are going to need to get involved in community organization because you're going to be depending upon the people you live with, the community you live in, to help support you.
And what option are you pursuing, just for out of curiosity?
Well, we are talking about moving to a larger town or just outside of a larger town, oh, about 20, 25 miles away from here. It's a, for one thing, a college town, so it's a little more liberal in its behavior. Has a little more availability of goods, you know, a larger library. It does have a clothing store.
Clothes are good.
Clothes are good. Stay open, but there are enough people there. There are enough people there to hold on to some of the amenities of cultured society. Let's see. Other things you need to think about are when if you move someplace else, you are going to be the new kid on the block. You are not going to know that area as well as where you live now. And if things get really bad and you have remained the outsider, you could be persecuted for being the stranger in the community. Mm. If you wait until after things get bad to try and make a move, it may be too late because once things have gotten bad and there are large numbers of displaced people, then communities are not going to be very accepting of newcomers.
Talk about, you mentioned growing most of what you need. Put that in literal terms. I mean, because I don't think that even myself, that I could conceive of the range of what I really need to eat.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I think that for most of us, we will be incapable of growing most of what we need to eat. You're going to have to find some sort of a farmer's market or something to buy probably a large part of your grains and other substances. If you like meat, then you're probably going to have to find some place to procure a lot of your meat, unless you want to specialize in small animals, say chickens, rabbits. One farm animal that I recommend highly is goats.
Mm-hmm.
For the milk products, the dairy products. They require much less land than a cow, and actually the milk is a little easier for human beings to digest than cow's milk.
You can ferment it and make cheeses and all sorts of things.
Yes. What I have heard in different studies is that for one person in a sustainable agricultural setting where all of the livestock is fed with feed that is grown on that farm and all of the livestock's wastes are recycled into the farm and all of the other wastes are recycled into the farm, I've heard that it will take about a half acre per person.
Half acre per person.
Yes, and that includes recycling all of that person's waste.
Mm-hmm.
In the form of, you know, say a composting toilet or something like that.
We're talking with Dale Allen Pfeiffer. He is the author of an article, Eating Fossil Fuels, and also a forthcoming book of the same title. As we've gotten further along in our discussion, I imagine some of our listeners, their heads are sort of spinning. And that we've sort of entered the range of the apocalypse. Do you get that response from people?
Well, the biggest response I get is disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
That people just don't believe it or don't want to hear about it. They'll say, oh, well, you know, that's not going to be a problem. We've got ethanol, we've got fuel cells, you know, but we're going to do something else. We'll go into outer space and we'll mine the rings of Saturn.
You can grow goats on the moon. Yeah.
And you have to actually sit down and explain, and I've had to do this over and over again whenever I approach somebody new with this. You have to sit down and explain that, no, I'm afraid this won't work and that won't work. I'm due actually this Saturday to give a presentation in New York City. And as part of my presentation, I'm going to state that techno fixes don't exist. There are some small things that could help. You know, solar cells are good, you know. Wind turbines are good, but we will never be able to replace more than a small proportion of our fossil fuel usage with solar panels or wind turbines. It just will not happen. When you look at the amount of energy right now that is generated by wind turbines or solar panels, it's mm-hmm. almost non-existent compared to how much energy we derive from fossil fuels.
It's maybe 4% is the number I'm thinking of. At the high end, yeah.
Maybe.
And,
yeah.
You know, even if by some fantasy that we could ramp up production, it's certainly not going to happen on the scale that we need it to. You know, I mean, if politically what we're looking at even now is the potential of bombing Iran.
Yeah.
You know, so on the table is the possibility of a barrel of oil being $100 by the end of the year. And that number's been thrown around for a couple of years now. But if that's possible, we're looking at, you know, a couple months from now, not being able to get our Cheetos.
Yes. Yes.
You know,
we're talking about, well, you know, if the price of gas goes up to $5 a gallon, and say, speaking for my own self, we try to confine ourselves to only spending $20 on gas per week. So if gas costs $5 a gallon, that means 4 gallons of gas.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, yeah. And you're in Kentucky. I mean, we're in Southern California where people drive. That's the way they live. We don't.
Yeah.
We spend more time in our cars than in any other way. So it's going to have an enormous impact.
Yes.
Yeah. Nathan, you look like you have a thought.
No, I'm just... I'm thinking about the future. That's my thought. Yeah, and how we get out of this gracefully, and knowing what I think I know about people, I don't think graceful is something that applies to most of the population, and that frightens me.
Well, you know, personally, I personally am a procrastinator, as Nathan knows.
Yeah.
You know, so if you project this onto the, you know, a community scale and a national scale, it's not too hard to see why, you know, we're sort of in this crunch now where all of a sudden, you know, the chicken poop is going to hit the fan.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if it's going to be pretty. You know, just do the best we can.
Yeah, is there anything that people can do? I mean, you know, that's, you've said a lot. I mean, they can grow their own and they can try and build communities. But other than that, I mean, is there something, I guess, politically there are things they can do. Anything else?
Well, for most people, what I'm suggesting, because the problem that I and others who have been involved in this for a while have had, is that we will try to start up an organization to deal with it in our community or, you know, elsewhere, and nobody comes to the meetings, nobody gets involved in it,
yeah,
except us and a few other people. But what I'm trying to say right now is that perhaps that is enough for the moment, because when things get bad, people will come out,
yeah,
and they will ask, you know, what's going on, what can I do, you know, and all we need to be able to do at that point is to stand there and hand out the hammers and the saws and point at what needs to be done. Now, in the Mountain Sentinel, in the first issue of the Mountain Sentinel, I had a large article about Argentina and what happened to the people of Argentina. And that's one of the most positive things I can think of to mention to people. Argentina, the people there were much more atomized than the people in the U.S. are. They were not only atomized but terrorized. They had a 10-plus year dirty war where over 30,000 of their, 30,000 people disappeared. And people just, learned not to talk to others, not to get involved, and to just look out for themselves. Well, when Argentina collapsed, everybody came out of their houses. They started talking together. They banded together to create community groups, community barter organizations, and businesses that were closed up were reopened by the workers as worker-run businesses. It was a pretty dramatic example of how people can work together. And I think that we can do it in this country. We did it during the Great Depression.
That's true.
Certainly in this case, we're talking about something that, there's not going to be an end to this. We're not talking about something we're going to recover from in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think that that there is a very good possibility that people will come together and work on this. I don't think we can look to our leaders for it because their interests lie elsewhere.
Well, on that note, Dale Pfeiffer, thank you so much for coming on the Politics of Food today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Good luck there in Irvine, Irvine, Kentucky.
Yeah. Irvine. You should hear how they pronounce Athens.
Okay, well, have a great afternoon there, and thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.